Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege once again to present Dr. Nick Begich, along with Gene Manning, the author of Angels Don't Play This Harp, with two A's, subtitled Advances in Tesla Technology, published in softcover by the Earth Pulse Press, copyright 1995. Dr. Begich, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thanks. It's good to be back with you.
We've been discussing in the first half hour, in addition to a review of some of the possible applications of this technology, we have begun a discussion of some of the possible misapplications of this technology. And what I mean by that is possible unintended side effects, and some of those side effects could be absolutely devastating. If we could pick up with what we left off with, and that is some of the possible effects on the human organism of some of the electromagnetic radiation coming from this technology.
Sure. I mean, besides the fact that you can, you can influence behavior, the idea that this could be accidental or purposeful, the idea that you could influence the general health of populations, those are all startling, startling things. The other thing that shows up in the literature is in terms of the human being when it's still in the womb. At this point in development, humans are exceptionally susceptible to all kinds of toxins. In fact, as it relates to toxic poisonings, 1/50,000th of the dosage that adults can be affected by can affect a child while in that embryonic state. With electromagnetic radiations, there were 6 tests done by the U.S. Navy, 5 of which showed conclusively that electromagnetic radiations in the ELF range could have a devastating effect on unborn children. So here you're dealing again with a technology that inadvertently could have a horrible effect in terms of creating some cell mutation that manifests itself in serious problems for unborn children.
One of the projected applications of the technology is weather control, and yet you quote a number of scientists as saying that the experimenters admit freely that they don't know exactly what the outcome of their experiments might be, and you compare this with finding a sleeping bear and poking it in the butt with a sharp stick to see what happens.
That is there, and it's a good analogy, because one of the things that the military has said is that they're going to deliberately perturb, as they call it, the ionosphere, disturb it in such a way as to create an increase in the chaos that already is there, to see if they can basically push it into a total state of chaotic behavior, and then see where, in fact, it resettles or restabilizes without any knowledge of where that level might be, if it exists at all. It's very scary from the standpoint of, this technology is, they're messing with a portion of the environment that's absolutely critical to life on the planet, and yet they're willing to deliberately take these steps and play with this as if it were a toy in a physics lab. In fact, some of them have even called it the a plasma lab in the sky, and I think that's a really dangerous way, as do many other scientists, of approaching our immediate environment in terms of technology. And, the whole issue of environmental experimentation, I think all of us now are pretty sensitive to the idea that the military has not been the most responsible in this area and a number of others in terms of how they look at the Earth itself. And I think as our sophistication has grown as a population, we're more quickly realizing that the environmental debate is more than garbage in the street. We're talking about something that has potentially a profound effect on every living organism on the planet, and this technology is by far no exception.
The ionosphere is vital to the continuation of life on Earth. If you could briefly mention or discuss the ionosphere and why it is so essential.
Sure. The ionosphere, is there by virtue of natural processes, but it in fact acts as a shield, keeping incoming particle streams, X-rays, and cosmic rays of various kinds of radiations from entering our immediate environment. If these radiations could enter the environment without being restricted, it would alter the genetic blueprint on the planet to such a degree as it would affect all life, not just human, but all living organisms. It's a very important part of the environment. It's one that doesn't get a lot of attention, but certainly it shouldn't be discounted. The problems that could be created by breaches of the ionosphere are much greater than the things that we hear discussed relative to ozone depletion and ozone holes. I mean, that lets ultraviolet light in, which can cause sunburn and maybe skin cancers in the extreme cases, but this is much, much more important. And here's a situation where the military is deliberately trying to breach the ionosphere for weapons applications.
One of the possible, there are a number of speculative elements that you discuss in the book concerning some truly alarming, as if this wasn't, the things we've talked about so far weren't truly alarming, but some of the absolutely cataclysmic possible side effects, unintended side effects of this technology. And you discuss some of the ruminations by atmospheric scientists concerning the overloading of the ionosphere with electromagnetic radiation and concerns that perhaps during a sunstorm or some other time when Project HARP was being activated, it could actually create a short circuit between the Earth and the sun that would destroy the Earth. Or the Earth, and, yeah, am I correct? The Earth and the sun or the Earth and the atmosphere?
The Earth and the magnetosphere, which is where there's a huge amount of energy potential. And what,
right,
what's envisioned here, in fact, it again comes up in the ideas of Brooks Agnew, who has read our material since publication, and as well as others, and we even found a NATO document dealing with ionospheric modification to deliberately shunt energy down or drag it down, if you will, by providing a conduit by which, a path by which that energy could flow. And what's envisioned here is that if HARP is powered up at a time when circumstances are right and the frequency being pulsed is right, that it could act as a conductor, and the ionosphere is a charged body, and essentially all of the electrons would start to move down this shunt. And the way Brooks Agnew described it was that it would be like the most powerful bolt of lightning hitting the same place on the Earth 40 times a second, until all the energy in the ionosphere in terms of electrons in that area stopped flowing. So, I mean, you're talking about a huge, huge discharge, short circuit, if you will. And one that, you know, when we talked about it in the book, we talked about it in the context of the worst, absolute worst-case scenario. And, you know, we published it. Brooks Agnew read it. He came back to us and said, you know, that is the worst-case scenario, but it is one that's plausible. And in fact, he's even talked about it on camera in some interviews as being one of the greatest concerns that he has about what this might actually do, either, again, inadvertently by the ignorance of the operator, just not looking at it from all perspectives.
Another possible unintended side effect and cataclysmic in its implications concerns the slowing of the Earth's rotation. And I wonder if you could not only develop that for us, Dr. Begich, but also explain how this technology would do that, because it's something I don't comprehend. I suspect the same is true of the listeners.
You know, it's one of those things that really, to be fair, is on the very edge of where we think it could go. And it's the whole idea, once you start interfering with the dynamo or the dynamic of the planet in terms of its electromagnetic field lines that are controlling, you know, lots of factors, and we don't really understand all of that at this point. I mean, we're still discovering it as the scientific community is looking at the Earth in differing ways as each decade goes by. But one of the concerns is when you, like with a generator, once you start playing with the magnetic fields, in a generator, you affect the speed in which in which it turns. And here you have a system that's deliberately injecting a huge amount of power into those natural magnetic lines of force that could, in fact, influence that dynamo. So, I mean, from that perspective, and again, on the very edge of speculation, for sure, HARP could, in fact, play a role in that. And, you know, when you look at the planet itself, it's already demonstrating great destabilizations, I mean, in terms of weather and climate. I mean, there's no doubt that what we're seeing is dramatic, more dramatic than anyone would have speculated even as recently as a year or two ago. And yet, here we are at a time when things are very unstable, and we're about to inject billions of watts of radio frequency energy into an already disturbed system.
One of the concepts that you talk about in terms of some of these disastrous unintended side effects is conservation of energy. Is that the correct term? We're talking about if in fact the ionosphere, for example, gets so overloaded with electromagnetic radiation, it's basically going to discharge down to the Earth.
Right, and this is again along that same line as what Brooks Agnew was talking about. And again, the question is how much energy does it take, and you know, and what does it take to discharge the ionosphere? And there's lots of lots of concern about it. And, you know, the way that we more or less see it is when you put energy into the ionosphere at the right frequencies, you can create energy releases or triggers. In fact, Stanford University found that by pulsing very low frequency energy into the ionosphere, where it couples with the magnetosphere, which is even higher up, it ends up amplifying up to 1,000 times, and then the energy returns to the Earth. And when you think about that, it amplifies. It's not like pulling energy out of nowhere. It's just triggering, like, again, like the primer on the end of a bullet, and causing energy to release, this time instead of in the Earth, in the upper reaches of the ionosphere. But again, it's, if you provide a pathway for that energy to flow and you trigger those kinds of events, the possibility of that energy flowing back onto the Earth is certainly there. I mean, the only good news in that would be if it happened very quickly and knocked this facility out and the lines were broken. I mean, they'd basically take themselves offline, which might be a good lesson for them. Unfortunately, the risks that might go along with that might not be so good for the rest of us.
You talk about the possibility of the Earth's magnetic poles actually reversing as a result of an unintended side effect of this technology. Could you explain not only what that might do, but what might cause it? Because, again, this is something that's at the frontier of understanding for most of us.
Sure. You know, this issue of pole reversal has been around a long time, and the idea that, that the Earth will reverse again is not new, and I think most geologists at least accept the fact that that's the way it works. It does reverse from time to time, and then there's some debate on whether it's a fast reversal or a slow reversal. In other words, is it cataclysmic or is it gradual? Most geologists believe those kinds of changes are gradual. Personally, and along with some other specialists around the world, I believe that those things are cataclysmic, and there's plenty of evidence to point that out. The idea that the Earth right now is demonstrating instabilities is clear. The idea that certain things are occurring within the magnetic lines of force to indicate that naturally there's some destabilization that might be either a pole reversal or a pole shift, which, in fact, pole shifts are even more frequent. According to Hapsgood, who is a professor in New England, his view is that the pole has shifted 4 times in the last 100,000 years, plenty of evidence to support that, not reversing but shifting. Even if this just created a shift or helped along or was a straw on the camel's back at a time when that shift was going to occur at some future time, here you have a situation again where we're injecting energy more or less like kids playing with toys, trying to play God with our environmental systems in the hope that we're right, while at the same time recognizing that we're creating instabilities, without any knowledge of where they might stabilize, or in fact, if they ever will stabilize. And you know, it's reckless approach to environmental science from our perspective, and one that deserves the kind of discussion that we're having here today.
It brings to mind a quote that a statement Albert Einstein made in regard to the development of the atomic bomb, and I think it applies even more now with regard to this and some of the other technologies that are on the horizon or being developed. He said, "Everything has changed but our way of thinking," and I'm afraid that's the case here.
You know, that is, I think that is the case, and, you know, the whole idea that... first of all, the question comes to mind is, why do we need weapons technologies like this right now? And if we do need them, let's discuss the full trade-offs and ramifications. I mean, it's as if we're in a rush to end ourselves, you know, thinking that we're protecting ourselves. And, you know, it's that mindset of everything results in, you know, conflicts that only the strongest can survive, that kind of mindset. And I think that many people that we meet around the world are really tired of this kind of exercise, of the artificial divisions that exist and the creation of a lot of energy and impetus towards developing weapons technologies. The thinking hasn't changed. I mean, it's as reckless now in many respects as it was then. The difference is our technology has advanced, making the toys in the hands of these guys much more volatile than even atomic and nuclear weapons that we've all come to understand what that all entails.
It brings to mind the fact that we're basically the same, as I say on my weekly radio show, we're the same femur-cracking, marrow-sucking Neanderthals we've always been, but we now are approaching the capabilities that even a relatively short period of time ago would have been envisioned as only accessible to a supernatural being, some sort of deity or spirit or something, and yet now it's real.
Absolutely. You know, the mind of human beings is remarkable. I mean, whatever basically we can conceive, it seems like we can create it. And I think this is the case here, is here are systems that were conceived decades ago that gradually, as time has progressed and the energy of individuals has been put into it, we've done it. I mean, we've created it, and then what's envisioned for the future goes even further. And this is mostly done and primarily done, behind closed doors and out of public discussion. And that's something that has really more recently, been there, I think, in terms of weapons, only in the last 50 years since World War II. But it's a time when really the opposite ought to be happening. We ought to be opening our doors and talking about what's possible, what these weapons capabilities are, not telling people how to build them, but certainly discussing their ramifications and implications, so we can decide as a population whether this is the direction that we want to go. And I believe most Americans would agree that this is not the direction we want to go, and would do a great deal to stop it as they find out about this technology.
By way of rumination, there have been a number of alarming weather manifestations. Well, there's always been disastrous weather as long as history has been recorded. There have been a number of observations about global warming, and of course there have been the advocates that in fact that's not taking place. Some people say, well, no, actually we're going to head into an ice age. Discussions of the damage to the ozone layer. As I speak, in mid-October of 1997, in the state of California, people are bracing for the effects of El Nino, which is a warm ocean current which tends to produce a number of different effects, especially with regard to the weather. Ever since I became aware of Project HARP, and I know that other people have shared this experience, and this is entirely by way of anecdote and rumination here, whenever something strange or apparently out of the ordinary happens with the weather, we sort of wonder, you know, is it live or is it Memorex? You know, is this nature? Or, you know, are they cranking it up there in Alaska? And one wonders. I don't think there's any definitive way of knowing whether this El Nino, which at least in terms of the projections we're seeing now in the papers, are saying this is going to be the most dramatic manifestation of this in 100 years, and there have been frank discussions in our major media out in California that we may be experiencing the worst weather, the worst winter we've had in 100 years or of this century. And one wonders, is this natural? Is this perhaps Project HARP? And I don't think there's necessarily a definitive answer to that, but it I think, at least tends to frame the debate about how important this is.
You know, I sat in on a discussion with parliamentarians from the former Soviet Union and from European parliaments where this issue of climate change was being hotly debated, whether it was natural or man-made. And the consensus at the end of that debate, which is pretty interesting to observe, was that, look, it's a combination of factors. There's a natural cycle, this solar cycle that we've been talking about in the news. You've seen it in the news. The solar cycle calendar, if you will, was moved from 2002 peak to something like 1999 peak, which means if it really is one of those driving engines for the exacerbated El Nino that we have now, I will say this, is that this summer and what people are projecting for this year, this coming summer and this winter, is going to be nothing compared to what we're going to see in the next couple of years and then coming on the other side of that as well. In other words, it's going to get worse. And, you know, people were saying this 5 years ago and everyone was laughing and no one was listening. You know, now no one's laughing and everyone's listening, and the idea of climate change is clearly in everyone's mind. This year we had 10 to 15 degree temperature changes off the coast of Alaska, which a year ago, if you had suggested was possible, there wouldn't have been a single straight face in the room. Everyone would have been laughing. Yet this is exactly what's occurred. It's been well documented, and it actually started before El Nino did, and there's not been a very good explanation for why. Why would these temperatures start to rise? What would be the trigger event? What could cause the ocean to rise, you know, to that degree? And you're talking about a huge amount of energy to raise ocean temperatures even 1 degree. I mean, and you're not only talking about the idea that, okay, now you get warmer oceans, you get warmer weather, that means Arctic areas melt, but you also get expansion of the water itself. I mean, it expands when it heats up, which is part of the contributing factor to ocean rise. And here in Alaska, we have some situations occurring with the winter storms that indicate, you know, ocean height rising slightly, but slightly enough to create some serious problems along the coastal areas of Alaska. And I believe the western states will experience some significant coastal impact, not just from the El Nino effects of immediate rainfall and that kind of weather, but also from the idea that sea heights are generally rising, tidal heights are generally rising. So I think that's a greater concern. And the belief, at least that I see, is that we have a combination of both natural and man-made factors contributing to this. It's certainly plausible that HARP is part of that mix, as well as all the other energy sources that men have created. But also something that's not generally spoken about, not much in the news, is the fact that off the coast of South America, about 600 miles, there are 1,200 volcanoes that have been charted, many of which are active at any given time. And although I read that some years ago, I haven't seen anyone give us a current update on what might be happening geophysically under the ocean right now that might be contributing to this heating up effect, because it does center right in the same area as El Nino.
There has been some speculation in the media that perhaps the sudden warm current that is El Nino might have stemmed from the eruption or some sort of manifestation of underwater volcanic activity. In that context, we should remember that in addition to altering the weather, one of the possible applications of Project HARP would be to trigger volcanoes and or earthquakes.
Right. And so here you again have the question, are we doing it to ourselves and not realizing what we're doing? Or is nature doing it to us? Maybe it's getting even. Who knows? But the point of the matter is, at the time in which these things are manifesting and things are showing instabilities, we are about to engage and embark on an even bigger injection of energy into an already destabilized system. And herein lies the risks, and herein lies the cause for discussion and debate before it is indeed past the point of no return on this project.
One of the things I wonder about, too, with the millennium drawing to a close and with all sorts of pop culture predictions about all kinds of things, ranging from, you know, Jesus returning after a whole lot of, you know, disasters and or miracles, one wonders, and this, again, hovers at the perimeter of consciousness, one wonders about the possibility of some very cynical and power-hungry people perhaps deliberately creating a catastrophic weather, catastrophic seismic events, or something of that kind, by way of creating a millennial situation that could be ripe for political manipulation.
You know, that certainly has come up, and it does periodically come up. And, you know, who knows? I mean, there are some very evil people in the world. I know there's a quote that we used in our book by Zbigniew Brzezinski talking about this kind of technology, and what he suggested was that no matter who was in power, either liberal or conservative, the temptation to use it to further political ends would be greater than the good sense to restrain. And Zbigniew Brzezinski certainly was in a position of great responsibility as national security advisor to Jimmy Carter, who would know the personalities of a lot of these players, and for him to suggest, didn't matter who it was, but if they had the opportunity, they would use it. I think that says it all. I mean, it doesn't have to be an idea of Nick Begich's. It's an idea that someone in a much greater position of power than I, and it was his speculation, and I think that speculation was well-founded. I mean, power does strange things to people. Technology is the handmaiden of every politician. Every powerful country is powerful only because of its technology.
And, of course, Zbigniew Brzezinski was the national security advisor for Jimmy Carter, and it was in the Carter administration that the U.S. and former Soviet Union approved a treaty regulating the environmental modification for the purposes of warfare and many of the things that we're talking about, such as weather control, storms, earthquakes, volcanoes, etc.
Absolutely. In fact, it was sort of the outgrowth, I think, of when Brzezinski was at Columbia University and was talking about the evolution of these technologies. He was well aware of them, and then as National Security Advisor, I'm sure it was a priority of his to try and limit the use and development of the technologies. The unfortunate thing is so much of our budget is in black projects where it doesn't matter what the policymaker does, the programs go on, and they go on without accountability and without scrutiny by either the public or the politician. I think that's the root of the problem, both here and in many other areas. And it's the and therein lies the solution as well, is getting control of those kinds of laws, bringing them back in, and getting them changed is really going to be the root of how this project probably ends and how others fail to begin.
With regard to the political ramifications of this, one of the points that we made in our earlier discussions is that this technology can be utilized at home. This isn't just going to be used on Saddam Hussein or whoever. It also could be, according to current U.S. law, used at home.
Absolutely. In fact, these laws that restrict the use for conflict situations with declared enemies of the United States, in other words, in warfare situations, they actually exempt domestic use. It's okay to use them in domestic situations. They just can't use them when they cross an international boundary, which is ridiculous in and of itself, because how do you create an event that doesn't trigger something else? I mean, things are pretty connected. But the whole idea is they can be used domestically without any restriction, probably have been, at least to the experimental state, done in that way. More than that, a lot of the technologies in terms of non-lethal weapons, even chemical and biological weapons treaties, exempt domestic use. You can, what you can't use on someone else, you can use at home. And all of that should be highly disturbing to Americans, because when we pass these international treaties, we should be passing parallel legislation that forbids what is not allowed in a warfare conflict, certainly ought not to be allowed on the soil of the country that's signing that kind of an agreement.
On a somewhat more optimistic note, although your work has sadly been overlooked by an awful lot of people and institutions in the United States, the European Parliament, at least, has taken considerable note of your work on Project HAARP.
Absolutely. In fact, Tom Spencer, who chairs the Foreign Affairs Committee in the European Parliament and the Defense Subcommittees, has been a great friend in terms of approaching this subject. He was sent our book, from a person down there in the L.A. area, just a lay person who sent it to him, said, "Hey, Tom, you need to read this." He read it, contacted his own independent scientist, came back to us and said, "Look, you know, this is a big problem. We need to address it." And he has provided us some very important forums for getting this issue out in Europe, and he's intending to bring forward resolutions in opposition to this technology and its related technologies within the European Parliament, hopefully by the spring. So it is advancing in terms of the opposition to it. We're starting to see a lot more interest. Tom Spencer's a conservative in the European Parliament, and he's forming coalitions with liberals within that body, so I think that the necessary strength to see it at least come out in a definitive way in the next several months is very possible. More than that, we spent a couple weeks with him and a number of other people recently in Europe, and I think there's an awful lot of interest, and I think there's some very, very good people in the right positions. Unfortunately, they're still in the minority, but at least they're there, that are willing to bring these kinds of issues forward, and once they do, I think they can muster the kind of support that's necessary to take it to the next step, which is strong opposition to the development of another arms race based on electromagnetic warfare systems.
Very quickly, Dr. Begich, if I could ask you once again to give the website and phone number that people can use to find out more about Angels Don't Play This Harp and or to order it. And again, we can't mention prices on the air.
Sure. The website is www.earthpulse.com, and the phone number is 907-249-9111.
And the address, once again, for Earth Pulse Press, Earth Pulse Press, Earth Pulse is one word, P.O. Box 201-393, that's P.O. Box 201-393, Anchorage, Alaska, abbreviated AK, 99520, USA. Once again, Earth Pulse Press, Earth Pulse is one word, P.O. Box 201-393, Anchorage, Alaska, 99520, USA. That's the address to get Angels Don't Play This Harp, co-authored by Gene Manning and Dr. Nick Begich. Dr. Begich, it's been a pleasure to have you back once again.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
And for Nick Begich, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.